please the court, appellant's challenge to an Army Corps of Engineers regulation is timely under the reopener doctrine. In 2003, the Corps conducted a proceeding in which it reopened, reconsidered, and promulgated a decision generally reaffirming a regulatory regime, including the regulation appellant's challenge. Just the other day, this court held that the reopener doctrine applied in similar circumstances. This is the Environmental Defense, Inc. versus EPA. The considerations there apply here as well. The Corps, in its January 15, 2003 Federal Register notice, created the opportunity for renewed comment on an objection to the regulation. It explicitly invited comment on the regulation and invited commenters to suggest alternatives, and it discussed the great importance of reviewing the regulation in light of the Supreme Court's decision in Swank, which had drawn the regulation into serious question, and the Wilson case, which had directly held it to be unlawful. The Corps received and carefully considered over 133,000 comments. The Corps then promulgated a decision and it posted it
on. When you say promulgated, you mean that it's final agency action?
I would say that it was, yes.
And do you agree that it has to be? I got the impression from your brief that you think it doesn't have to be.
I do not believe that it has to be.
Then how do you have a cause of action to come here if it's not final agency action?
We have a cause of action under the Constitution, 1331, which we've cited as a jurisdictional basis.
Well, I'm not sure. I have several questions about that, but the first one of which is, are you attacking the regulation as unconstitutional?
Yes.
I thought you were attacking it as outside of the scope of the statute, because the statute's been limited by Swank, which is...
Well, the regulation specifically states that the that it is relates to a situation in which there could, quote, could be interstate commerce connections. And this, under those circumstances, would violate the Constitution.
So your argument is not that it's not authorized by the statute. Your argument is that it's unconstitutional.
Well, we think it also is unauthorized by the statute as well.
Well, have we ever implied a cause of action under the statute when you have the APA available to do the same thing? I'm asking you, wouldn't you just, under the theory you just stated, aren't you limited to a facial constitutional attack only then?
Well, we are making a facial constitutional challenge.
Only.
We also would have, we gain jurisdiction under the Constitution, but we would also be able to attach to it a challenge to the...
Gain jurisdiction, but where's your cause of action?
The cause of action is that the, both that the regulation is contrary to the Constitution and to the, and to the statute itself.
Your complaint seems to say that even under this regulation, there's no wouldn't apply to you. Isn't that right? That is, reading your complaint, it sounds like your argument is that this would not that under the complaint, under the regulation as written, it would not apply to your land. Is that right?
Well, we certainly hope it would not. But
I'm not asking what you hope. Don't you allege in paragraphs 20, 21, and 22 that there's no recreational boating, there's no commercial fishery, and it's not used or diverted for industrial purposes?
That is correct.
So,
and yet at the same time, there have been three instances.
Well, that's a different question, just for the moment. Your allegation is that this regulation, as written, does not apply to you. Right,
we believe that that it would not properly that it would not apply to us. And
so
yet,
what I don't understand is how you can force the court to make a constitutional decision about whether this violates the Commerce Clause or not, when you have available an as applied challenge that would avoid the constitutional decision. Don't we normally try to avoid constitutional decisions?
Well,
aren't you? I would say, organizing your papers in a way to force the court to do exactly what it normally shies away from doing.
Well, a facial challenge, as this court has indicated in Sabre, is normally considered to be available and ripe for consideration by the court.
Is it not true that we normally have tried to avoid constitutional decisions when a non-constitutional basis exists?
But in effect, that would be denying us our facial challenge. We are faced with a situation where we're stuck with what amounts to a Hobson's choice. We can go forward and try to get what this court in the National Association of Home Builders versus Army Corps of Engineers has called a gauntlet under the Army Corps of Engineers procedures. We should not be faced with a Hobson's choice of either going forward and bearing all the burdens and the costs.
Couldn't you at least ask for a jurisdictional determination?
That in itself is a tremendous burden. We're not required to do so. We've had a situation in which three of our neighbors have had a jurisdictional determinations that have been rendered in relation to them. And we, under those circumstances, we should not have to await that happening again. Just the other day, in the Biggerstaff case, this court indicated that the evidence of past wrongs are evidence that it's going to happen again. We should not have to await a...
But there was also a final agency action in that case, in the Biggerstaff case. There was a final agency action.
Well, again, we're challenging a regulation under these circumstances, and in a situation where the agency has rendered a decision, which it did in this case, and clearly has rendered a final decision.
I'm sorry, you're talking about the adoption of the regulation.
We're talking about the reaffirmation of the regulation in 2003.
Press terminated the ANPRM.
Yes, that's correct. Well, it didn't terminate it. The agency reached a final decision in relation to that. And the agency had specifically stated that it had found had considered the 133,000 comments, had found them helpful, and thought that they had a wide breadth of opinion. And one of the alternatives was that it take, quote, no action at all. In other words, that it reaffirm the regulations.
Suppose that after Swank, the head of the Corps had a press conference, and it says, terrible decision, but we're, of course, try to live with it. And we don't really know exactly what we should do, the various possibilities. He outlines the possibilities, says, we welcome any suggestions anyone has. Send us a letter at, and caption it such and such. And a lot of 133,000 letters come in, and the Corps says, finally, well, it's all too confusing. I don't think we'll take it up now.
Is that a
reopening?
I think that is certainly a different case than what we have here.
Well, how is it really different?
Well, it's very different.
You tend to leave off the, or to disregard the impact of the magic word advance in talking about the notice of proposed rulemaking.
Your Honor, we have to take a look again at what the agency actually finally did. After it received the 133,000 comments, it carefully considered them, and it reached what it called a decision. Again, I'd like to refer specifically to what the agency said. It said that it wanted to preserve the government's authority to protect the wetlands. It was reaffirming and bolstering protection of wetlands, and the words that it used, reaffirmation of federal jurisdiction, reaffirm, bolster, preserving authority, reiterate commitment, and continue. And the agency clearly made a decision. It called it a decision. And it made a nexus between the consideration of the comments and the decision. And the agency also, emphasize here, amended its regulatory regime by jettisoning the migratory bird rule and also adopting some procedures. So the agency clearly was involved and not just simply throwing up.
Well, the agency had not much choice about the migratory bird rule. Right?
Precisely, but the migratory—that's right.
It could have said nothing, and the same result would have flowed.
Well, but the agency was in a situation where the migratory bird rule was on the books, and what the agency said was, "We are not going." They made a specific statement that we are not going to apply that. In effect, what
is that? That's in the notice of proposed rulemaking you're talking about?
Yes.
In the same notice, they attached this compliance guide or this guidance.
That was in that. Yes.
Yeah, and the guidance says we're going to do this on a case by case basis. Don't do anything without contacting headquarters. Blah blah blah. That doesn't sound like they're making a final decision. That sounds like they're going to decide this case by case.
Well, but the thing is, they kept the regulations on the they kept this regulation on the books. They said, well, we'll see how it may apply, but it kept the regulation on the books. It jettisoned the migratory bird rule, which showed clearly that they were involved in rulemaking.
So
it reaffirmed the rest of the regime, including
before they even issued. This is in the advance notice of proposed rulemaking.
In the advance notice of
even before they had the rulemaking, they had already decided.
No, what they had was they published this almost as an interim final rule. The memorandum, they said, here's what we're planning to do during the duration of this. They put in the memorandum. And then they said, you know, we want to have comments on this. And then they looked at it. For example, they said at the same time, the agencies reaffirmed federal jurisdiction over the majority of wetlands not impacted by the decision. I'm looking at the decision. It said, after soliciting public comments to determine if further regulatory clarification was needed, the EPA and the Corps decided to preserve the federal government's authority. So in effect, they reached a sort of an interim final decision on January with that notice that you've the notice and the memorandum that were attached and said, well, we want to get the comments. And then they reached the decision with all these affirmatory language here. And now the agency is backpedaling and said, oh, we were just simply gathering some preliminary information, but it's simply untenable. They carried through to a decision. They call it a decision. I want to emphasize here that the issue of advance notice of proposed rulemaking versus notice of proposed rulemaking really doesn't make that much difference under the reopener doctrine. In Public Citizen, for example, versus the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the issue arose in the context of a reconsideration of a policy statement without any kind of notice of proposed rulemaking. And in CropLife,
Public Citizen is a case where they have a policy that is explicitly temporary, and then they, as they promised when they adopted that policy, after 2 years they look at it and they say, aha, we will make it permanent. Now that seems to me clearly a permanent adoption for the first time of the policy.
Well,
there's a lot of talk in Public Citizen, but that's the holding.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor, but every single case turns or involves separate facts. I mean, the CropLife situation, for example, involved simply agency statements and a press release. The issue is the substance of what the agency did and not the form. That's the key, because an agency otherwise could simply manipulate its forms and evade the reopener doctrine. The touchstone.
No, this is a different. When you say evade the reopener doctrine, the real question is, does the reopener doctrine evade the statute of limitations? Right? It's the statute of limitations that's the statutory bar here. The reopener doctrine is a doctrine of this court, and as far as I know, probably only this court. And it's meant for narrow circumstances where there is final agency action. In fact, in Public Citizen, the court expressly says that the 1987 action of the agency was not a reopening because no final agency order issued. It was only the later 1988 one in which there was a final agency order. So we're still stuck with this question of whether what they've done here is a final agency order.
Well, let me say that the touchstone is whether an agency, and I'm quoting now Public Citizen, is whether an agency has in fact reopened an issue either explicitly or implicitly, because an agency has an ever-present duty to ensure that their regulations are lawful.
I think there's 2 points, I think. One is, have they reopened it in the sense of thought about it again? I think they have here. I think you're quite right about that. The government's quite wrong. But even when they start thinking about it again, they still have to issue something that we have authority to review. And all of our cases indicate that that thing has to be a final agency action.
Well, actually, the other day in Biggerstaff, the court took a look at the issue of Public Citizen. Again, I would refer the court here to public citizen 901 F2D 150 to 153, where the agency, the court says where an agency's action shows that it has reconsidered the rule and decided to keep it in effect, the challenges to the rule, meaning the original rule, are in order. And then they reemphasize this. There, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission reopened and reexamined and reaffirmed its 1985 decision, and that, quote, reconsideration made the decision, 1985 decision, subject to renewed challenge.
Yes, but what Biggerstaff expressly says is when the original rule is reinstated so as to have renewed effect, and talks and notes that in Biggerstaff what was at issue was a final rule. So that we still have this problem that we don't, do we have a final rule here?
Well, again, I think in the Biggerstaff case, the court said that the complaint was not against the new rule. The complaint was against the old rule, was specifically against the old rule. Now, you can phrase this in terms of whether the challenge is against the renewed adherence to the regulation or against the regulation. You've got a regulation here that's sitting here like a rock. It was put in 1986, and it continues forward all the way through to today. In 2003, the agency says, we agree, we think it's right. Despite Swank and despite Wilson, to heck with Wilson, that's just in the Fourth Circuit, or the heck with the Supreme Court, we're going to reaffirm this. And they reaffirm it. Now, whether or not you call our challenge to the reaffirmation or a challenge to the regulation, I think it, as Gertrude Stein said, a rose is a rose is a rose.
Well,
I think
if
it's
you wrote a letter,
the same thing.
If you wrote a letter to the agency, and the agency wrote back and says, yes, this rule is still in effect, that would start the statute of limitations over again?
I don't think so. I think that under those circumstances, I think that would fall more in the line of the Sendra case, which was dealing with the gun case, where they said if they just simply said, you know, we've turned down your decision, and it'll be more like the National Mining Association case, where the agency said, "Well, we received this petition. What do you folks, what do you folks think about it?" We've got a very different situation here, where the agency has specifically, basically, I think, thumbed its nose at the Fourth Circuit, and thumbed its nose at the implications of Swank, and said we are going to have the maximum power that we think that we can to protect the wetlands, this is the reason we're going to go for it. They provided reasons.
What do you make of the things that they've issued with respect to Rapanos?
Well, I think actually that's very helpful to us. If you take a look in the Appendix D to our reply brief, you'll see that they have specifically stated that the 2003 memorandum, there was a 2003 guidance, remains in effect. So as far as the Rapano situation is concerned, that does not change the fact that the agency is still going to follow its 2003 guidance. In fact, they've really reaffirmed that guidance.
Let us hear from the agency.
Yes, I'd like to reserve a couple of minutes.
Couple of minutes.
Yeah, thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Anna Katselis and I represent the United States Army Corps of Engineers. With me at council table is Dan Inglis from the Corps. I would like to address two points. The first is that PNV lacks standing to pursue their facial challenge to the Corps' regulation because PNV has suffered no injury in fact. The facts alleged by PV do not establish that the Corps has asserted jurisdiction over any water on the Barstow property.
They have this affidavit in Addendum A that talks about these telephone calls. What is the court to make of that?
Well, I believe that's in their complaint as well. They allege that they.
Mr. Brown makes these statements.
Right. They allege that that the Corps told them in a verbal communication that it was asserting jurisdiction over the Mojave River, and they also rely on this 2001 fact sheet. Neither of those things constitute a jurisdictional determination for any water on the Barstow property. They simply are not that. PNV's basis for standing is a legal conclusion, and this court is not bound to accept that legal conclusion and should not do so because the facts alleged.
Their argument is everybody around them, jurisdictional determination has been made that the Corps has jurisdiction. They've gotten these telephone calls. The Corps says they're going to assert jurisdiction. And they say they can either go forward and face potential penalties, or they can ask the court to address this now.
Right. I think there are two points.
What more do they have to show, given that we have said in our cases you don't have to wait?
Well, they have to show. I think there are two points related to standing I would like to make. The first is that in their complaint, their standing allegations read as if the Corps had at that time asserted jurisdiction. That's wrong. That's not supported by the facts. To the extent they allege that that
an assertion. We take the allegations of the complaint to be true that the Corps has stated they are going to assert jurisdiction.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, for purposes of standing, we take the allegations.
You have to take the factual allegations as true, and the factual allegations in the complaint are this verbal communication regarding the Mojave River, which is not on their property, and the 2001 fact sheet, which is nothing but a fact sheet. It identifies potential interstate commerce nexuses. From those factual allegations, Your Honor, they allege that the Corps asserted jurisdiction. That's wrong. As a legal matter, that's wrong. To the extent that they argue they have standing because an assertion of jurisdiction is imminent, which I think was really only crystallized in their most recent 28J letter, I think that's also incorrect. In order to have standing based on a future injury, you have to show that it is certainly impending, that it is imminent. They have not done that.
Well, do you have a distinction between between the Barstow property and the property covered by the three JDs, which are attached to Mr. Brown's affidavit?
Well, they've never sought a jurisdictional determination, Your Honor.
I understand that. But what they're saying is that, looking at what appear to be parallel situations, the Corps finds jurisdiction. And a natural response for you would be, no, they're completely wrong. Those were completely different circumstances with respect to A, B, and C, but I didn't see that.
Well, again, there's nothing in the record here. I mean, they allege that the waters.
Well, the JDs are official decisions of the Corps. Is that correct?
The JDs, the ones that they've attached are approved JDs,
okay.
Which means that they could be appealed, and if they weren't.
Right. So they're not final, you say.
Right. They're not final. They're not subject to challenge.
But they're actions of the Corps, right?
Well, they're.
Okay. I mean, is there some reason to think they don't manifest Corps policy?
No. I think, but. I have a very important point to make about the imminence of this. The JDs that they do attach, one were issued in 2004 and 2005 before the Supreme Court decided Rapanos. And I think in determining whether an assertion of jurisdiction is imminent, the court would have to take that into effect because, again, it's a legal conclusion.
Has the court in some official way indicated an intention to make a substantial retreat in the face of Rapano?
Well, the Corps has issued new guidance under Rapanos
an intention to make a substantial retreat?
Well, it sounds from what your opposing counsel
said.
Can I have an answer?
Can we get an answer to Judge Williams' question?
They've issued new guidance. I don't know if I'd want to characterize it as a retreat, but regardless of that, the Corps is obviously obligated to apply Rapanos to any future decisions. And Rapanos concerns ephemeral waters, which they allege that they have. So the fact that the Corps may have issued these JDs in 2004 and 2005, when the universe consisted of swank, does not at all establish that the Corps would do so now. The other thing that we would point to...
Before you go on to the other thing, could you look at Appendix D, which is what your opposing counsel believes to be the guidance on Rapanos? And the third page of which says, from now on, we're going to require, before we decide jurisdiction over ephemeral washes or intermittent streams, they will have to meet the Kennedy significant nexus test or the plurality standard.
Correct.
Now that, I assume, was not the rule before Rapanos because nobody knew what those standards were.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
That does sound as an answer to Judge Williams' question that something new is going on here.
Well, the legal regime has certainly changed. It's absolutely changed. So to the extent that they are relying on an assertion that the Corps will necessarily assert jurisdiction over these waters because it asserted jurisdiction in 2004 and 2005, it's a legally incorrect assertion. It just can't be known. It's not at all, it can't be considered imminent, and therefore it can't be a basis for standing. So because of that, and also for the reasons we've already stated, they certainly haven't established that the Corps did assert jurisdiction over any water on their property. There's a very real standing problem here. So those are the points
Is this a standing problem or a rightness problem, or is it both?
It's really both, Your Honor. And I think that the hardship prong of the ripeness test really overlaps with the injury in fact question. And I think that although PNV is cited to cases in which this court has adopted or taken on facial challenges, those cases have been very different from the circumstances presented here. And I would say, from the cases I've looked at, including Sabre and it's been clear that the party challenging the regulation was a regulated party. It's not even clear here. It's not clear that they're even subject, that this regulation will ever be applied to them, much less that it will ever cause them hardship in a real and concrete way. So I think it's both a standing and a ripeness problem, Your Honor.
What is the status of the three JDs that are attached to the Brown affidavit?
All I can tell you about that, Your Honor, I don't know anything about the property or the development on that. I mean, the next step.
Are there appeals by the
property I believe that they were not appealed. That's what I found, that those three JDs were not appealed. So the next step would then be to, if they wanted to apply for a permit, and through that process, the plaintiffs have stated that they could not build because of an assertion of jurisdiction, and that's not even true.
The assertion was it would diminish their building rights.
Well, that's not even true. I mean, they could be granted a permit and be able, the Corps could authorize them to build in a certain way, so it's not...
Well, the affidavit is they'll lose 175 acres, isn't it?
So something like that, but there's no basis for that determination. There's no basis. I mean, these are all legal conclusions about what an assertion of jurisdiction would do, and they're not accurate, Your Honors.
So your point is until there's a jurisdictional determination where they check the box approved, there can be no showing of imminence of injury.
Well, I don't know if I'd even go that far. I just think that certainly in this case, there's nothing imminent. I mean, it might be a different situation if these JDs were issued,
Well, I just want to see how far you're pressing that.
Well, I'm not sure. I think it would be a different, it might conceivably be a different situation if, the Corps had issued JDs and had made it clear that it was asserting this regulation.
And they issued the press release. Really hanging your hat here on the latest Supreme Court plurality, right?
Well, I'm for standing purposes, I think.
For standing, what I'm getting at, they have the surrounding neighbors, they have the telephone call, and they have the press release.
Right.
The Corps is not going to change its regulation.
Correct.
And your argument, I thought, to that was, well, it's not even clear the regulation would apply to their property.
Yeah, it's not. That's not clear.
But then you say, additionally, now we have this new Supreme Court decision, and we have this new guidance.
Correct. I mean, I think all of those factors together, you know, in this case indicate that it's, there's a definite lack of imminence and injury. I think.
Can we go back to the three JDs? I take it that an effort to reverse them could be made either by the private parties or by the Corps itself. Is that correct? I mean, I assume the Corps has the power to revoke a decision on the ground that it was based on a law that's become obsolete.
I'm not certain.
I can't imagine it wouldn't. But I take it that, so far as we know, neither any of the private parties nor the Corps itself has made any effort in light of Rapano to change those JDs.
Your Honor, I'm not sure about that. I'm not certain if the Corps has done anything with those JDs.
On the record before us, we have no reason to think that either side has done anything.
No, on the record before us, we don't. No. We don't.
On the question of final agency action, we do have decisions saying that when you have a notice of proposed rulemaking in sort of standard form and it's terminated with a decision to do nothing, that is final agency action. So if it were a notice of proposed rulemaking as opposed to an advance notice of proposed rulemaking, the plaintiffs would seem to fall within that case.
Well, I think the case I'm thinking of that was cited in the reply brief is Center for Auto Safety, and they found that the withdrawal of an ANPRM constituted a rule subject to review. So the plaintiffs could seek review of the withdrawal. I don't think fairly stated the plaintiffs are seeking judicial review of the press release. I think that they are seeking review of the 1986 regulation.
Yeah, but the final agency action issue was not really briefed significantly, but to the extent that and that they do have to find a final agency action, it would seem to me that the cases on termination of a full-fledged rulemaking get them where they want to be.
Well, we don't have a full-fledged rulemaking.
That's the distinction.
Right.
But I think if you terminated a full-fledged rulemaking with a press release or some other final sign that it was ended, that would be it for purposes of final agency action. So our cases seem to say.
Well, I think in the context of this case, the final agency action issue arises in the context of the reopener doctrine, and I do think that we briefed that in that context. And there, you look to all of the circumstances of the rulemaking to determine whether a reopener has occurred. But certainly, as the first step, you do need a new rulemaking. You need a new order that is challengeable, final agency action.
All I'm trying to suggest is what's critical for your position is the initial letter A before this, or as part of this ANPRM.
I would also say, Your Honor, I think that I'm not sure that those cases, because they are in such a different context, I'm not sure that those cases get them to the point where they need to be. I do think looking at the reopener cases, which, as Judge Garland acknowledged, it's a limited exception to the statute of limitations. I think that you need more. But it would be a different case if they had gone to proposed rulemaking, but they didn't even do that. In this case, all that they did was issue an ANPRM asking for broad comment on SWANC, essentially inviting any comments that the public wished to submit, and then subsequently issued a press release announcing that they would not engage in a new rulemaking.
Just to pin it down, suppose that you'd have had a standard NPRM that was terminated by press release. I know that would be non-standard, but government sometimes does non-standard things. You wouldn't claim that there was an absence of final agency action there, would you?
I
understand your claim about that, your argument about how there might be issues as to what was made reviewable by that, but
okay.
You'd have final agency action.
Under this court's cases, I do think that, you have a final agency.
What about the evidence here that the agency views rulemaking as too time-consuming, so it uses guidance instead. And so here it's issued an advance notice of proposed rulemaking and attached a guidance. In other words, that there's a suggestion in the record that this is the way the agency does notices of proposed rulemaking, through guidances rather than what Judge Williams described as standard rulemaking.
I don't think the Record Act supports that characterization, Your Honor. I think that if you look at the ANPRM and the joint guidance issued with it, the ANPRM invites broad comment on SWANC, and the joint guidance indicates it was updated. It had been 2 years since SWANC was decided. It provided information on the case law and various circuits to the public and to the agencies making decisions, and that was issued in contemplation of a future rulemaking, but the agencies opted not to take that step, and that is important. The agency's choice not to reopen the rule is significant. The agency did not conduct a new rulemaking. It did not issue any final order, any reviewable action that could restart the statute of limitations, period. So I just don't think that the record bears that out, and I also don't think it could be used as a way to find that the statute of limitations period was reset.
When you and Judge Williams are discussing the standard idea at the end of a notice of proposed rulemaking to not issue the rule, what case are you talking about?
The only case that, and I don't know these cases, the case that was cited that I had looked at in the PNV's reply brief was Center for Auto Safety.
Right, but that case really doesn't advance our ability to decide this. That case says that's true when the agency explicitly indicates that its decision to terminate rulemaking is intended as a means of choosing the status quo over other reasonable alternatives. Thus, to the extent that its decision is a binding decision not to adopt or enforce improved, in that case, fuel efficiency standards, there's final agency action, which, and then it goes on and says, which normally would be ripe for review, but in this case, even in that case, wasn't even ripe for review because it wasn't clear whether they would change their mind again.
Right.
So
that is correct.
So stuck with the question of what the agency, even if this weren't an advance notice of proposed rulemaking, even if this were a notice,
right,
we'd still be stuck with interpreting what this press release and compliance guidance mean.
Correct. And I think on that question, I think that's absolutely the correct analysis. And I think that the answer here, I mean, number one, I think it is the plaintiff, in all of the reopener cases that the Corps has found, the plaintiffs were seeking to challenge a new rule or order that had been promulgated, and the agency was arguing they were time barred because they had addressed this in a past rulemaking. This circumstance is very different. They are not seeking to set aside the press release, and the press release is not final agency action because it has no legal consequences. The 1986 regulation would remain on the books and remain in effect had the press release never been issued, had the ANPRM never been issued. So for these reasons, I don't think that there's any way in this case, certainly, for the reopener doctrine to apply. Are there any other questions? Thank you.
Counsel for appellant.
Your Honors, the Rapanos guidance at Section 8 specifically states that the newly issued Rapanos guidance does not supersede the agency's 2003 guidance interpreting SWANC.
But I'm with you that this is confusing and that they, you know, don't seem willing to act. There's no doubt about that. But that doesn't solve the problem. They do say in this case that they're going to follow the Kennedy and Scalia opinions.
I don't know how they can follow both. But again, that's different
than what they were saying before.
Well, the agency has, again, what we're dealing with in the SWANC case is a situation, and we're dealing with here, you recall the SWANC case dealt with a matter of a of a gravel pit, and a bird flew across the state line and landed in it.
Right.
And so there, like this case, we're dealing with an interstate isolated water. The Rapanos case is dealing with other issues, dealing with substantial nexus with navigable waters, et cetera. So they are dealing, and again, the agency has said, Rapanos is different, we're going to continue to follow to 2003. But the point is also as to what the agency has done here. The counsel for the other side has said, well, gee, they didn't end up doing a notice of proposed rulemaking. There was nowhere else for the agency to go. It had run out the string. Having decided that it was going to affirm, which it did, all the language in its December 2003 decision, it had reached a final decision. There was nowhere else for it to go. Having decided that we are reaffirming the regulation, they didn't have to then make a further proposal. They had run the string out. Let me also mention that the question came up about as applied challenges versus constitutional facial challenges. General Electric Company versus EPA, 360 F3D 188-191, which we cite at page 8, the footnote 5 of our reply brief, specifically states that a statute prohibiting as-applied challenges does not bar pre-enforcement review of facial constitutional challenges to the statute.
I know that, but
I'm
sorry.
The parties really haven't briefed that issue as to whether or not you can bring a pre-enforcement challenge here.
Well, again, we have addressed it, and it's have addressed it in our reply brief, and specifically cite the case that would deal with that. Again, briefly on the issue.
Can I just ask you about that just for 1 second? I'm sensitive to this because this was the National Park Hospitality case in which this court did entertain a facial challenge, and
yes.
The court said, "Sorry, you're," and it wasn't even disputed that that was okay on the rightness grounds, and the Supreme Court reversed. Considering an issue that the parties had not raised and decided it wasn't ripe, even though it was a facial challenge. And they specifically said that things are not fit for review necessarily because they're a facial challenge. And I'm wondering why this isn't a similar problem.
Well, I believe that the Sabre case, I believe also referencing the National Association of Home Builders versus Army Corps of Engineers does indicate that a facial challenge is presumptively ripe. With respect to the issue of standing, again, we feel that we clearly fall within Sabre. The experience has shown, and again, in the Biggerstaff case, when you have past wrongs are a good indication of the potentiality of bearing on whether there's a real and immediate threat.
Of course, that was a personal experience here. The Corps' argument is this regulation may not even apply to your.
Well, but the personal experience, I mean, the law of physics says that water runs downhill, and it's going to, it ran downhill to the, as a tributary to the Mojave River in the other three cases, it's going to run downhill in our case as well. So we have.
What should we do if we think that you satisfy standing on the allegations on the basis of your complaint? What should we do next?
Your Honor, we would request that the case be.
We decide that there was you would then move on to the reopening question?
Yes.
But isn't that a merits question? And don't we first have to know whether there's a factual dispute about the standing question?
Well, but again, that question, again, we're dealing with a facial challenge to that regulation. In effect, what you're saying is that we would then have to go through an as-applied challenge in order to see if we could.
Well, maybe you would have to go back to the district court and establish not just that you claim on the face that these other JDs were the same as you, but that they were actually the same as you.
But, Your Honor, that's precisely the gauntlet that this court has said that that's exactly precisely the thing that we're trying to avoid.
No, I'm not. Maybe you're misunderstanding. The question is, can we decide your standing based only on your allegations and the complaint?
Yes, absolutely. Again, we're dealing with the jurisdiction, the three jurisdictional determinations, the laws of physics, the laws of economics. With 175
but what if the government's position is that streams that you're talking about are different? That the JDs are different for some reason than your case.
Well, you would have to go through an as-applied situation to reach that. The thing is that under Sabre, there is an immediate impact on our ability to make decisions. Again, it's precise, and that was in the Sabre case, the ability, the affecting our ability to make decisions.
But in Sabre, they held that the same kind of company, these CSRs, were within their jurisdiction. And there was no dispute that Sabre was one of those. But in this case, we don't know whether there's a dispute because the district court, this issue wasn't raised in the district court. As Justice Scalia said in Lujan, everything depends on the stage of the proceedings. When it comes to summary judgment, there actually has to be a factual determination.
Well, we certainly believe are the facts in our complaint certainly indicate that we have the ability to move forward, and we are facing a Hobson's choice, classic Hobson's choice, that we either face a unlawful assertion of the agency's jurisdiction, or else go ahead without that, without that, and in effect putting ourselves in a situation where we're facing severe civil and criminal penalties. In that type of situation, we're, again, as the affidavit said, they're between a rock and a hard place. They've got a project that they're trying to move forward with. Your suggestion would be, well, let's wait and continue to wait and hold up this project while that would happen. And again, that's the very gauntlet. As we know, a gauntlet is a form of punishment.
That's one way to put it. The other way to put it is you're asking us for an advisory opinion.
No, I'm not.
There's a spin on both sides with respect to
the description. No, it's absolutely not an advisory opinion. We have laid out all kinds of harm. Both imminent and actual. I mean, we've spent money dealing with this issue, both before and after the complaint was filed. We have the people dropping like flies right and left as our neighbors. We've got the Hobson's choice. We've got the incurrence of cost, the 175 units, which we potentially can't build. Those are certainly matters of tremendous imminence, and nothing like the concept of something speculative or ephemeral or a situation such as in the energy case where there was an advisory opinion because there simply wasn't a live deal there. This is very different.
Well, in that case, the company was saying that they had to spend $22 million to align their interconnection agreements with the new rule, and the court still said that there was no standing.
But they had no live agreements, and that was the reason for holding.
They were spending $22 million.
But they had no agreements, and so therefore that was the point, that they simply had no agreement. The fact they had abandoned the agreements. I realize there's an issue there of mootness versus standing, which is a matter of substantial interest, but I think the key in that case is that there were no agreements, and therefore they were in the position of anybody else who was interested. We are not in that position. We've got a live project which we're trying to move forward with. We're not just somebody who's coming in and interested in the situation. We've got a project. We're trying to get the thing done, and we're facing all an immediate impact on our ability to make decisions. With all of those other things, the 175 units, the $120,000, the money that we spent before the complaint was filed, the laws of physics, the adverse determinations, again, all of that we think creates standing. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.